Being involved in the conspiracy to kill three people, two of which just happen to be your own children, can really age you. Barry Morphew and his daughter speak out. Living a secret double life. What could possibly go wrong? We have a Brian Koberger update, and then finally our dumb criminal of the day. Let's talk about it. Good day, everyone. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Thanks for joining us. You know the drill. Before we get started, like if you do, subscribe if you haven't, leave me a comment, hit that little bell for notifications, and remember, you can listen to us anytime on any of your favorite podcasting apps. Let's also support the people that, well, help keep the lights on here at Crime Talk. First, crimetalksearch.com. Go there. Sign up for that background subscription service. You'll be happy that you did. Now, when you sign up for this subscription service, which you can cancel at any time, you can do one search, you could do 1,000 searches. That's right. Anyone here in the United States. And you're going to get information as to whether they are on one of those public registries. Have they been in trouble with the law before? We've had more people contact us and say, Scott, I was getting ready to get involved with somebody, and I found out that they had a conviction for wrongs to minors. Think about that, ladies and gentlemen. Find out who you're dealing with. You can't just trust the Google search. Go to crimetalksearch.com. You're going to be happy you did. All right, let's go ahead and open the record for May 15th, 2023, and let's start the docket. Now, as everyone that was watching the Lori Vallow trial, or in this case, listening to the Lori Vallow trial, since the judge thought that we were all so unsophisticated and would be traumatized and would somehow jeopardize Lori Vallow's right to a fair trial, we couldn't get to watch it. All we got was the audio. But if you listened to it, you found out she got a pretty fair trial. Frankly, if we had to judge it, I would give the prosecutors a grade of a B. I don't think they crushed it. And I don't think there was anything particularly that was new that we didn't already really know. As it relates to the defense, I'd have to give them a C minus if I was grading them. I just never felt any passion whatsoever. At least you can do is try to fake it and put a little passion in there. It was one of the most bizarre opening statements I've ever heard. The closing argument for the defense was completely jumbled, disorienting, and I just didn't think that he was giving up. I thought he was giving up is really what it came down to. But then I thought, maybe this is not his master plan to win at the trial. No. Maybe it's what I'm going to talk about here in just a minute, okay, that most people aren't talking about. So, as you know, Lori Vallow, you know, didn't really express a whole lot of emotion when she was found guilty of all counts in her trial last week. She was then handcuffed and then taken out of the courtroom, where she was then going to be booked back into the Madison County Jail. And guess what? We have a new mugshot. Now take a look at these mugshots of Lori over the years. Yep, is it just me? Not being judgmental in any way, I'm sure I'd be exhausted too after that trial. But doesn't it really look like jail has aged her considerably? I think it has. Probably the stress of everything that's going on, right? Just something to think about. And you have to remember, the average age of somebody in custody, the life expectancy of somebody in custody is about 72. So she's only got a couple 20 years ahead of her, so to speak. Now, what is going to take place with Lori Vallow next? Well, the court ordered a pre-sentence investigation report. And really, that is just information that the court needs to make a full consideration as to the appropriate sentence. Now, obviously, Lori Vallow is looking at life without parole. But it's going to provide background information as to her education, her family life. Was there abuse? Anything along those lines. Marital status. The normal stuff that goes into any pre-sentence investigation report. But here's something that most people aren't talking about, at least the stuff that I've read. Now, do you remember all the talk about basically not guilty by reason of insanity? Idaho doesn't have a not guilty by reason of insanity statute like we saw here in Colorado with the Letitia Stauch case, okay? Pretty simple. Because when you have a not guilty by reason of insanity statute, you can say, hey, I did it, but I was crazy. Suffering from a mental disease or defect at the time, I couldn't really judge right from wrong, all right? Now, remember what the prosecution kept jumping up about. If the defense is going to introduce anything as it relates to mental capacity, then we want to know about it. And what did Mr. Archibald do? Mr. Archibald said, eh, we're going to save all that good stuff for sentencing. Guess what? Here we are, coming up on sentencing. So here is the relevant statute in Idaho. It's Idaho Code Section 19-2523, Consideration of Mental Illness in Sentencing. And I'm going to read straight from the statute so you think, hey, Scott, you're not making this stuff up. Evidence of mental condition shall be received if offered at the time of sentencing of any person convicted of a crime. In determining the sentence to be imposed, in addition to other criteria provided by law, if the defendant's mental condition is a significant factor, the court shall consider such factors as the extent to which the defendant is mentally ill, B, the degree of the illness or defect and the level of functional impairment, the prognosis for improvement or rehabilitation, and the availability of treatment and the level of care required, any risk of danger which the defendant may create for the public if at large, or the absence of such risk, the capacity of the defendant to appreciate the wrongfulness of her conduct or to conform her conduct to the requirements of the law at the time of the offense charged, and the court shall authorize treatment during the period of confinement or probation specified in the sentence if after the sentencing hearing it concludes by clear and convincing evidence that A, the defendant suffers from a severe and reliably diagnosable mental illness or defect resulting in the defendant's inability to appreciate the wrongfulness of the conduct or to conform his conduct to the requirements of the law. Without treatment, the immediate prognosis is for major distress resulting in serious mental or physical deterioration of the defendant. And finally, treatment is available for such illness or defect, and the relative risk and benefit of the treatment or non-treatment are such that a reasonable person would consent to the treatment. In addition to the authorization of the treatment, the court shall pronounce sentence as provided by law. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. What does that really mean? If, as we know, Lori Vallow was not competent for at least 10 months, the question was how much farther back into the future, further back into the future, was she not competent? One would argue that she was delusional, as her attorneys kind of mentioned in their closing arguments. She was going through a difficult time in her life. She was being manipulated. She was thought to believe a goddess, that she was going to get all this power, which she didn't get. She didn't get any power. They got, what, 6 followers, I think, is what Mr. Archibald said. Money, looks for, you know, from trading in the prior husband for Chad Daybell. No, clearly someone must not be all right there. So what does that really mean? Well, it means whether the judge decides to send her to a state mental health hospital or whether she goes to the Department of Corrections there in Idaho. I would guess that the defense is saving a lot of their ammunition, i.e. all those mental health professional reports, for sentencing. Now, is that really going to happen as far as Judge Boyd's doing that? I don't know. I would tend to doubt it, but you have to say, hey, this is the law. And judge, since we don't have a not guilty by reason of insanity, we're going to send somebody off. We know she has a mental disease or defect. You restored her to competency. It took 10 months. We were concerned that it was going to have competency issues again. And here we are, judge, and they're going to go into a lot greater detail for that. So don't be surprised if that's what the defense argues. Nobody seems to be talking about it, but well, hopefully that's why you come here to Crime Talk, because, well, you have an actual lawyer who's tried cases trying to figure something out. Now, obviously, we have Chad Daybell's trial. Nothing's been set, but he wants his trial in June of 2024. In all honesty, unless they just need that much time to pay the attorney's fees in the matter, I don't understand what they're waiting for. Go try this thing. Facts aren't going to get any better. They're only going to get worse for Chad Daybell. Go try the darn case. Next on the docket, the Morphews break their silence. Suzanne Morphews' daughter and her husband, Barry, broke their silence regarding the vanishing and disappearance of their mother, where charges were obviously dropped against Barry Morphew. As you may recall, Barry Morphew was charged back in 2021 with the murder of his wife, Suzanne. She allegedly vanished while on a bike ride there in Salida, Colorado, on Mother's Day of 2020, and her body has never been found. Remember, prosecutors said they knew exactly where it was, though. Yeah, that was last summer. Well, the prosecutors dropped all charges against Mr. Morphew after the judge sanctioned the district attorney's office for complete incompetence. Now, he and his daughters have spoken out about their trials and tribulations, and DeBerry explained that Suzanne had made bad decisions because she was struggling with drugs and chemotherapy while battling Hodgkin's lymphoma. When asked about Suzanne, Barry Morphew told an ABC News reporter on Monday morning, "We had a wonderful life and marriage. She was just so loving and giving and such a good mother. I know that she was going through chemotherapy for the last couple of years before her disappearance. I know she was going through some hard things and made some bad decisions. She was having trouble with chemotherapy and the drugs." Now, Barry also said that it broke his heart to find out that his wife, Suzanne, was having an affair with somebody that she went to high school with, obviously, years ago. Now, holding back tears, he said, "My heart was broken." He just didn't believe it. When asked how the ordeal has left them, the daughters, Mallory and Macy, also told the reporter, "It's very, very sad, very confused, so traumatic. Literally anyone's worst nightmare." Now, defending himself when asked if he had anything to do with the disappearance of his wife, Barry said, "Absolutely not. It's hurtful to lose your reputation and your integrity." Standing with their father, though, the daughters were asked if they ever questioned in any way whether their dad was innocent. Mallory responded, "I've never had a shred of doubt." Macy said, "Not one." Now, slamming the prosecutors who believe that Barry was involved with his wife's disappearance, he reiterated, "They're wrong. They've got tunnel vision. They look at one person and have too much pride to say they're wrong and look elsewhere." And that's oftentimes a problem with a case, is that the prosecutors focus on one person and they tried to build evidence around that person instead of looking at all the evidence and let the chips fall where they may. Next on the docket. Remember the San Francisco Cash App homicide of founder Bob Lee? Well, it kind of reminds me of the 12 undeniable truths of life from a criminal defense attorney. Yep, everybody's got a secret. Everybody has a double life. Let me give you an example. So the Cash App founder, this Bob Lee guy, was allegedly quite a regular at underground sex and drug parties with other San Francisco elites, including the sister of the man accused of killing him. Now, Lee's stabbing was on April 4th, and it was originally thought that it was a result of some sort of random violence by some homeless person in that hellhole of San Francisco that we are knowing it to be coming. But friends of the tech mogul now say it was the result of Lee's partying with Kazar Momeni, the 37-year-old wife of the prominent plastic surgeon, and the sister of Nima Momeni, who has been charged with his death. Now, Kazar and Lee were in a relationship in the weeks leading up to his death in early April. His friends have made statements to that effect, and many feared he had fallen into a dangerous lifestyle, surrounding himself with a wrong group of people. Now, prosecutors have previously said that Momeni stabbed Lee in the heart multiple times after vowing to come down hard on him and grilling him over his relationship with Kazar, with whom the Cash App founder exchanged some intimate text messages. Are you starting to notice a trend, ladies and gentlemen? Sex, drugs, alcohol, cell phones, secret lives. That's right. Makes the 12 undeniable truths of life from a criminal defense attorney seem more and more relevant every day. Anyway, friends of the tech mogul describe how the father of two took drugs casually and partied pretty regularly. People have said that Lee was passionate about developing the Venmo competitor following his career as a Google programmer. But to unwind, Lee, nicknamed Crazy Bob, would allegedly take ketamine and cocaine and travel the world to go to different rave parties. Now, prosecutors say that Nima asked Lee if he and his sister were doing drugs or anything inappropriate. Lee assured him that nothing inappropriate had happened. A few hours later, Lee was found dead with multiple stab wounds. Now, normally, partying is not going to be relevant as to why somebody got stabbed, right? But when the autopsy comes back and you have a pharmacy full of drugs in your system, guess what? Somebody's going to try to use that to their advantage. And the defense will basically try to say, well, maybe he deserved killing. He was aggressive when he partied, when he used drugs, and given the combination of drugs he was on that day, it was going to be self-defense. Just a humble prediction that I'm making there. We'll see how it turns out. Next, a Brian Koberger update. Some new court documents in the Idaho case have let us learn that a search of Brian Koberger's apartment, investigators discovered traces of blood in his bedroom and uncovered a previously unknown storage unit belonging to Mr. Koberger. Now, according to these documents, when the police approached the storage closet belonging to Mr. Koberger, nearly 2 months after the alleged quadruple homicide of Kaylee Gonsalves, Madison Mogan, Ethan Chapin, and Zaino Kernobyl, it was unlocked and the door was actually ajar. Police reported that it was covered with dust and cobwebs. No trace evidence was taken, and police didn't believe Koberger had used it recently, but the existence of this unit may be a break for law enforcement, as they think that it's plausible that maybe Koberger may have used it to hide items related to the murder, either before or after. We'll have to wait and see. So was it just a coincidence that he just had this place to store things, or was it a place for the murder weapon and clothes for them to be stored either before or after the homicide? We'll have to wait and see. Now, as it relates to the blood evidence found in the apartment, before we all get too excited, even though, yes, the test came back, it preliminary tested on the scene, as a presumptive test that it was, in fact, blood, don't get too excited. It could be his own blood. He could have had a bloody nose. He could have cut himself. Where is it found? What are the circumstances? Now, if it's somebody else's blood, like one of the victims, obviously Brian Koberger has got some real problems. But we'll wait and see before we jump to conclusions. Now, finally, today, our dumb criminal of the day, okay? Our dumb criminal of the day is a YouTuber, and he faces, guess the what? We've seen a lot of YouTubers do some stupid things that face jail time, but he faces a maximum sentence of 20 years in federal prison after pleading guilty to deliberately crashing his plane and recording the incident so that he could get views. Now, the United States Attorney's Office for the Central District of California released a statement saying that Trevor Jacob, an experienced pilot and skydiver, embarked on a solo flight from the Lompoc City Airport in Mammoth Lakes. During the flight, the attorneys allege that he intentionally ejected himself from the plane and recorded himself parachuting to the ground and his airplane as it descended and ultimately crashed. Jacob reportedly set up multiple video cameras on different parts of the aircraft and was ready with a parachute camera and selfie stick while flying over the Los Padres National Forest near Santa Maria. He then exited the plane and recorded himself parachuting down. The plane then crashed into a dry brush in Los Padres National Forest. In the video titled, "I Crashed My Airplane," Jacob is seen walking to the crash site and collecting the video recordings of the flight. Now, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office, Jacob alerted the National Transportation Safety Board about the plane crash on November 26th of 2021, and an investigation was initiated. The Federal Aviation Administration reportedly launched a separate investigation around 3 days following, and the attorney's office said Jacob lied to investigators that he didn't know where the wreckage location, even though he and his friend flew a helicopter to the wreckage site in December of 2021. And at the crash site, Jacob reportedly used the helicopter to lift and carry the wreckage to Rancho Sisquoc in Santa Barbara County. According to the attorney's office, Jacob destroyed the airplane wreckage in a hangar at the airport with the intent to obstruct federal authorities from investigating the plane crash. Jacob also submitted false reports and said that the aircraft experienced a full loss of power approximately 35 minutes after takeoff. He lied to an FAA aviation safety inspector when he said the airplane engine had quit, and because he could not identify the safe landing option, he parachuted out of the plane. His pilot's license was revoked in April of 2022. And the attorney announced that on May 11th, Jacob pled guilty to one count of destruction and concealment with the intent to obstruct a federal investigation. Now, I remember when this took place, it was kind of all the buzz in the aviation community because it made no sense. This guy who's going to fly a general aviation airplane, not an aerobatic plane, was putting on a parachute. You don't go flying with a parachute unless you're in an aerobatic plane or maybe you're going to jump out of it. Anyway, it made no sense. It was for views from the beginning, and obviously it didn't quite work out so well. Once again, don't live stream the crime scene. Yes, you are a dumb criminal of the day. All right, for those faithful viewers who made it this far in the video, just want to let you know, I start trial tomorrow. It's set for the next 9 days. We'll play it by ear, whether we're able to put up a daily video. We'll just have to wait and see. But if you made it this far in the video, now you know why, if you don't see me for a couple days. All right, thanks for watching. Have a wonderful day, and we'll see you next time on Crime Talk.